Long most days, she sat in his favorite chair, reeking of his cigar smoke, and read about the past, closing herself off from the future. Margaret continued her life out on the town once her bruises had healed, and while some astute members of the press noted that the spark seemed to have left Peggy Ives's eyes, this change was always attributed to the recent loss of the beloved patriarch of the Ives family. Margaret passed as much time as she could with her sister, but all Laura really did, aside from read, was sleep, with the aid of the pills the family doctor obligingly prescribed. Once the coverage of Gerald's death had dissipated and the news cycle hit its first lull, the pictures from the so-called rock and brawl made a renewed appearance in the papers. Margaret knew this because she'd become obsessed with tracking them since that night, but she never brought the papers home. For once, she was grateful that Laura was housebound, protected from the unkind things people were writing about her. Still, one night, Margaret had walked past another of her father's secretive phone calls and heard him whispering, "Laura's not like you, Bernie. She's not tough. She can't handle this kind of scrutiny." And the shame filled her up from her feet to her head. 3 months passed since her night with Cosmo. Occasionally, he sent Margaret letters from his home in Nashville. Letters might have been an overstatement. They were more like notes, short missives about things that had reminded him of her, or mentions of vague plans to be back in Los Angeles, well wishes for her and her sister. He always included Laura, which cracked Margaret's heart a bit deeper every time. She kept every letter. She replied to none of them. Gradually, Laura emerged from those first stages of mourning. She'd finished reading the journals and moved on to new territory, books about physics, biology, philosophy, religion. Sometimes she could be coaxed outside to read on a blanket alongside Margaret, with the makings of a tea party spread between them. Margaret kept waiting to stop missing the man she'd spent one night with, but when the letters stopped coming, she felt like a melon that had had its inside scooped out. She ached. She was lonely. Like she hadn't been since Ruth died. And before that, in those dark days when her parents' anger with and mistrust of each other had been so great that there was no room for anything else, even in a castle as large as theirs. 3 more months of silence went by. Margaret read about Cosmo turning 24 years old, about the raging star-studded party thrown at Chateau Marmont, and thought she might break in half at learning he'd been so close to her. It terrified her that one person could have so great a pull on her, that she could feel so much, that she could miss a person she didn't know. She wondered if something was wrong with her. Laura had become obsessed with a young, controversial psychologist whose book she'd read. She'd excitedly spout some of his nonsensical theories at Margaret, one being that people were always the source of their own pain. There was no logical reason Margaret should have felt this kind of loss at being disconnected from a total stranger like Cosmo Sinclair, which for the first, and frankly only, time, made her think Dr. David Ryan Atwood might not be completely full of shit. But time moved on, and she thought of Cosmo less and less, until finally, she stopped thinking of him at all. In 1962, 4 years after Margaret's grandfather's death, one of Bernie's films was nominated for an Academy Award. Margaret's stepfather, Roy, never liked attending awards shows, so sometimes Freddie would step in to escort his ex-wife. But that year, Bernie took Margaret as her date. Margaret wore a silver gown, her hair piled glamorously atop her head, while Bernie wore simple black, as was her approach every time she found herself in a situation where a dress was more appropriate than her usual slacks. Margaret felt more like herself that night than she had in a long time. It was promising. She and Laura would recover from the last 4 years, and things would go back to normal. That page would be refolded along its crease, and she would continue wandering through her sumptuous, extravagant, fun life. She talked, she flirted, she drank, she laughed. She and her mother rolled their eyes at the inane stage banter and roared their applause for their favorite films, actors, writers of the year. Or Bernie did, and Margaret followed her lead, happy to bask in the glow of her lovely mother. She felt filled back up by the time the night was over. She even decided to stop by the Board of Governors ball, the after-party that had started up a few years ago. Their driver took her to the doors of the venue, and she kissed her mother, who'd decided to head home, goodnight, then stepped out into the line of paparazzi fire, smiling prettily. She paused to pose for several who called out her name. Just ahead were Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward, who wore a beaded gown and long white gloves. They chatted with Margaret for a moment before heading inside. When she moved to follow them, her hem had been snagged underfoot by whoever'd stepped out from the latest car to arrive. She turned, her reflexive apology whizzing back down her throat before it ever reached her lips. "Hello," Cosmo said, his dark eyes glimmering, his mouth quirked in that funny, almost sheepish, heartbreakingly sexy smile of his. The smile that launched 1,000 teenage tears and plenty of shrieks of excitement around them now, even from a crowd of seasoned celebrity journalists. The flashes went off all around her, like distant stars exploding, imploding, significant, sure, but not to her, not then. She was barely aware of the actress on Cosmo's arm, an ingenue who'd been nominated for Best Supporting Actress earlier that night and lost out to West Side Story's brilliant Rita Moreno. Cosmo didn't seem too aware of his date either, his eyes glued to Margaret, his smile just for her. His date, for her part, was relatively unbothered, waving and posing for the cameras in a ruby-red Dior. The next day, those pictures would be everywhere. "Two-date Peggy and two-timing Cosmo?" one headline asked. "Stars collide at Governor's Ball," another article's caption began. There were dozens more, but only one felt right to her. One, she thought, was true. Cosmo Sinclair spots Margaret Ives, and the world stops. 28. When I get out of the shower Saturday night, my phone is still lit up on the counter with a new text from Cecil. I told him I was curious to see the photo of him in his hippie days, too, and he sent a grainy phone picture of the old film photograph. I wrap my hair in a towel, another around my body, and then open the message to get a better look, balancing on the edge of the baby pink tub. Nothing especially jumps out to me from the image. He's sitting on a boulder in front of some pine trees, smiling and waving. He's much thinner and less wrinkled, but the biggest difference between the Cecil of then and the one I've met is exactly what he prepared me for. His long blonde hair hangs past his shoulders, gleaming in the light, a thick blonde mustache slightly covering his smile. Is there something kind of familiar about him, or am I just staring so hard I'm willing myself into a sense of déjà vu? I forward the picture to Hayden, but don't ask any questions. I'll figure out why this picture matters on my own, or I'll wait until this game is over, but I'm not going to let him hand me any information. In the bedroom, I pull on my pajamas. Hayden and I decided to do our own things tonight, largely because we both could use the time to catch up on work, and we made plans to explore more of Savannah tomorrow. I only have 1 week to push as far into Margaret's story as I can and piece together a proposal and writing sample, and I'm going to need every spare second. But first, I drop the picture of Cecil into a reverse image search. Nothing noticeably useful turns up, and when I add the surname from his card, Cecil Wainwright, I still find nothing of consequence. Then again, it's not like I know what I'm looking for. I close out of the window, tie my hair into a stubby little ponytail, and pick up transcribing Margaret's story from earlier. The story. Their version. Cosmo Sinclair and Margaret Ives's relationship caused a rift in the Ives family that would never be completely repaired. Her version. He came to see her the morning after the Academy Awards. When Briggs told her, Margaret was giddy. She was terrified. She was hopeful. She was miserable. She changed her clothes 3 times, the last outfit being the one she'd already had on before Cosmo Sinclair showed up at her door and went down to meet him. But the library was empty. She traipsed back into the hall and heard voices from the breakfast room. She went toward them, unsure what to expect, and found herself quickly at the doorway, looking in on a scene that squeezed her heart ferociously. "There you are," Laura said, smiling with a mug of tea in hand.
I was just keeping Cosmo here company.
Cosmo here had lurched to his feet, his forehead canted slightly down, and mouth in that funny little shy smile of his that turned her inside out. Laura stood too.
It was lovely to meet you, she told Cosmo. Now, if you don't mind, I'm in the middle of a good book.
The pleasure was all mine, ma'am, he said, his drawl irresistible.
Laura grasped Margaret's elbow on her way from the room, and she took it as the sign it was. It's okay. She knew. Somehow, Laura knew. Margaret had no idea how, but there wasn't much room for guilt or shame over her secret right then. Cosmo had taken a slow, hesitant step toward her, his hands stuffed into his back pockets, chin still tucked to take her in, accommodating for their height difference. Suddenly, his closeness felt like too much. It overpowered her, stole her breath.
Would you like to go for a walk, Mr. Sinclair?
She said, more formally than she'd intended. His smile split open.
I'd like that very much. And you can call me Cosmo.
Cosmo,
she said, so quietly she was surprised he could hear it, but she knew he did because his smile grew. They walked through the orange grove, and while that was sizable, it wasn't enough. They wandered through the other rows of fruit trees and then circled the tennis courts. They wandered past the Roman-inspired outdoor pool and down to one of the lakes. They ambled through the rose garden, the greenhouses, the chapel, the various follies. At one point, they'd wound up at the very edge of the land, where they could look down over the cliffs to the water below, watch it sparkle under the sunset, because the sun was setting by then.
Would you like to go to dinner with me?
He asked. And she would. She would like to go to dinner, dessert, bed, breakfast, lunch, and dinner again with him. But she wanted to speak with Laura first.
Tomorrow?
She asked.
Tomorrow,
he agreed. When he'd left, she found Laura in her bedroom. For once, she was writing at her desk instead of reading. She smiled as Margaret approached.
So the rumors are true.
Laura looked tired, and she'd lost a lot of weight since Gerald's passing, but her smile made Margaret believe that maybe, someday, everything would be okay again. Playing along, Margaret rolled her eyes and flopped herself dramatically backward onto Laura's grandiose, hand-carved bed.
And what rumors would those be? You're in love,
Laura sang at her, then, on a giggle,
with Cosmo Sinclair?
Says who? Margaret rolled over and propped herself up on her forearms.
David,
she replied. David? Who's David? Margaret sat up the rest of the way.
My friend David,
Laura said.
Dr. David Ryan Atwood.
Dr. David? Margaret said. What she thought was, that quack?
Since when are you friends with him? Since I wrote to him 5 months ago and he wrote back.
She set her pen aside.
We've been corresponding, and talking on the telephone sometimes.
She added,
I had to hear about what happened at the governor's ball from him.
Nothing happened at the governor's ball, Margaret said.
I spoke with David earlier. He told me all about it.
Margaret felt a pinch of guilt.
I won't see him again.
Peggy!
Laura stood and came toward her sister, dropping onto the side of the bed and taking her older sister's hands in her own.
You can't watch me every second of every day.
Who says I'm doing that? She'd meant it rhetorically, but from the odd look that passed over Laura's face, Margaret realized there was a literal answer.
Dr. David, she guessed.
Laura squeezed her hands.
You need to live your life. Go out and fall in love, or travel, or do whatever else it is you're not doing while you're sitting here with me.
Margaret's throat twisted, her voice splintering.
I don't know how to be without you.
You won't, Laura promised. You won't ever be without me. There'll just be a little more space. It's a good thing.
What will you do? Margaret asked.
What I always do, Laura said. I'll read, and I'll write, and I'll go for long, marvelous walks.
Her smile dazzled Margaret. It made her feel like an ember in her chest had been gusted into a raging flame. It made her feel braver. She hugged her sister and didn't let go for a long time.
The next night, Cosmo picked her up for dinner. He drove them himself in a nondescript black car rather than his dark blue Ferrari Spider, and he wore a chauffeur's cap as a half-assed disguise. Margaret had dressed for dinner out, somewhere they'd be seen and photographed, but instead he took her to the house he was renting, and they walked down to a dark stretch of private beach with a picnic basket, a blanket, and a six-pack of beer he'd gotten from his trunk. They ate, they drank, they laughed. They took off their clothes and ran into the dark waves, and afterward made slow, patient love on the blanket.
"What is it about you?"
he'd asked quietly, reverently, pushing her wet hair away from her face as they lay together afterward. "I don't know," she murmured back. "Could it be my family's millions?"
"I'd marry you, Peggy Ives, if all you had to your name was a gunny sack and a can of corn."
"Are you proposing to me, Cosmo?" she teased him, but his face remained serious.
"Sure,"
he said.
"Why not?"
She laughed in disbelief, swatted his chest. "You're not serious."
"I am," he said. "Marry me."
"No," she said.
"Why not?"
he asked. "Because I don't know you," she said.
"What do you want to know?" he returned. "I'll tell you anything, and then we can get married."
"That's not how this works," she said.
"Honey, there's never been a me or a you before," he replied. "This works however we say it works."
"I say that two people should know each other's middle names, at least," she joked.
"Andrew," he said. "What's yours?"
She couldn't resist him. Not that innocent, eager expression of his, not the twang in his voice, not the smell of him all around her, or the heat of his arm draped over her waist, or the lock of hair damp against his forehead. "Grace."
"That's beautiful," he told her. "Maybe we'll name our baby that. Grace."
At that, she absolutely howled with laughter, but the joke was on her. They spent every day together for the rest of his time in Los Angeles, 2.5 weeks, and at the end of it, when he asked her to marry him again, it wasn't really a question. They both already knew the answer. The press had taken to tailing Margaret and Cosmo ever since the morning after that first date, when he'd gone to drive her home early, only to discover cameras waiting outside the gates. Every time they went anywhere after that, a crowd of reporters and fans alike seemed to find them, so they agreed to spend 3 days apart, a kind of distraction before they married at the courthouse, a faux breakup. He told only his security guard and his manager, who tried to talk him out of it, of course, and Margaret told only her sister. She and Laura had a miniature bachelorette party of sorts, staying up late eating snacks and candy and listening to records. Not Cosmo's, though. Laura wasn't there yet. Then sleeping together in the tent in their playroom like they had so many nights when they were girls. They woke before the rest of the house and crept out to meet the black car idling in the driveway. Cosmo Sinclair sitting behind the steering wheel in his chauffeur's hat again, a disguise that would fool no one at this point. A gaggle of paparazzi were waiting at the bottom of the house of Ives's drive. A swarm of cars followed them to the courthouse like a marital parade. Margaret was glad to have ridden with Laura in the back seat, where she could hold her sister's hand tight as her anxiety mounted. Again and again, she whispered her gratitude for Laura being willing to do this, and all that Laura could really muster was a tense smile and nod.
"It will just take a minute,"
Cosmo promised her, his eyes darting to the rearview mirror, his smile soft and reassuring. It was more like 10 minutes in the end. As soon as the courthouse came into view, Margaret forgot, however briefly, to worry about her sister. She felt only joy, rightness, and some amount of shock that the universe would grant her something so beautiful and precious as this without her having done anything to earn it. Then again, maybe love was always a gift. The only thing that couldn't be bought or sold or bartered for. Cosmo opened the door for the girls and, with a calming smile, gestured for the cameraman to step back so he could hand Laura onto the sidewalk. He ran her up the steps and dropped her inside with the nearest security guard, then came back for Margaret. When she stepped out onto the walk, she might as well have been floating. She didn't mind the attention. She didn't care whether no one or everyone watched what happened next. She hardly noticed the crowd swelling around her on all sides, jockeying forward, shouting, grabbing. Cosmo's warm hand took hers, and he tucked her against his side, physically blocking them from getting too close. She'd never felt so safe in her life. They were in and out of there fast. One of the other waiting brides was so awestruck at Cosmo's presence that she'd handed over her bouquet to him, her mouth gaping open. He'd thanked her earnestly and passed the flowers to his new wife, and then they left through the back door to get in a waiting car Cosmo had hired, their luggage ready and in the trunk. He'd send someone for the other car later. Now, he was eager to get back to Nashville to wrap up some business so he and his wife could take their honeymoon. Margaret tried to convince Laura to join them for either or both portions of the trip, but she'd wanted to get home to her books and her letters with Dr. David. So the driver took Cosmo and Margaret to their waiting plane, where they each hugged Laura tight on the tarmac and said their tearful goodbyes.
"I'll see you soon," Margaret promised. "A month at the longest."
"See you when I see you,"
Laura said, kissing each of her sister's cheeks, the wind from the engines billowing her hair across her face. It was a month exactly before the newlyweds came back to Los Angeles. They'd spent 2 weeks in Tennessee, during which Cosmo had canceled, delayed, or cut short every business dealing he had, aside from one hometown show, during which Margaret had watched from the wings, then made love to him in the dressing room like that first time. After that, they'd gone to Italy, a small town where they'd expected to find some privacy. Only the members of Cosmo's team closest to them knew the exact details, and still they'd been swarmed by international press from the moment they touched down. The poor man's Elvis was rebranded as the rich man's Elvis, a joke about his heiress wife. She didn't care. She didn't care either when they were dubbed the closest thing Americans have to royalty. They'd been relentlessly followed and relentlessly observed. They tried more disguises. They tried scheduling reservations at multiple restaurants and going elsewhere. They tried assumed names. They tried firing the suspected sources of the leaks, but a new one always sprang up. Every time the paparazzi captured a shot of Cosmo looking hunted or glowering, the headlines asked, "Trouble in paradise?" When they stayed in for days on end, tabloids ran stories about Peggy's rules and the short leash on which Margaret kept the famous former Casanova. The highs and lows of their public perception bothered Cosmo. While they'd been in Rome, his manager had told him about an article back home that lined up Margaret with the other women Cosmo had been loosely attached to, rating her face, her body, her talent, and her money against the others. It was the first time she'd seen him truly angry. He'd flung a coffee pot at the wall in his rage and paced like a caged, helpless animal. "It's all right," she promised, crawling to the edge of their bed and pushing up onto her knees to touch each side of his face. "I'm used to it."
"That doesn't make it right," he said.
"No," she agreed. "But we can't change the whole world with our love, Cosmo." He circled her wrists with his hands.
"I should be able to protect you. I should be able to protect your sister and anyone else you care about. If I can't do that, then what's all of this for?"
Cosmo had grown up without money, so he knew the value of a dollar. While he liked to spend, especially when it came to her or his parents back in Dennis, Tennessee, she'd also learned that his anxiety about money ran much deeper than his love for it. Not having it had been the greater strain, no doubt about it. But he wasn't at ease with having it either.
"I don't need you to protect me," she whispered, kissing him slowly. "I just need you to love me."
And he did, every minute of every day of that first month. She'd gotten two letters from Laura since they'd been gone, but both had come in those first 2 weeks when they were at Cosmo's Nashville estate. She was eager to see her sister, to prove that this hadn't been a mistake, that the universe had given her permission to love and be loved deeply by both of them. That she wasn't being greedy, and she wouldn't be punished for it. But Laura wasn't home, Briggs informed Margaret as soon as she and Cosmo had set foot in the vast marble entryway of the House of Ives.
"What do you mean?"
she asked. "Is she out on the grounds?"
Briggs cleared his throat, his eyes switching between Cosmo and her as if to indicate this was a delicate matter. He might have been Margaret's husband, but Cosmo wasn't and would never be an Ives. "Briggs," she said, "tell me where my sister is." The butler cleared his throat again, his face going beet red with embarrassment.
"Miss Laura is getting treatment in New Mexico at the moment."
"Treatment?" Her heart pattered through her chest, a loose pinball zigzagging against her ribcage. "Is she sick?"
"Did something happen?"
Cosmo pressed, one hand settling comfortingly at the small of Margaret's back.
"It is my understanding," Briggs said diplomatically, "that Dr. Atwood is assisting your sister with..."
"Atwood," she interrupted. "The psychologist?"
"Yes, Ms. Ives," Briggs said. "Miss Laura is at his center for the next several months."
She spun toward the library, the nearest phone. "Did she leave a number?" she shouted without looking over her shoulder. She'd made it all the way to the phone when Briggs finally caught up with her.
"There are no phones on the property, ma'am," he said. "But she left an address if you'd like to write." "We can go there," Cosmo told her. "Right now, if you want. Bring her home."
Briggs took an audible breath, and she looked to him, waiting for whatever he was going to say.
"She left you a letter in your room, I believe. She told me that would explain everything."
Margaret and Cosmo set off together, barreling through the castle. The ivory envelope sat in the middle of Margaret's bed. She tore it open, shaking out the paper within. "Dear Margaret, I am sorry not to give you more advance notice, but I have gone to New Mexico to work with Dr. David. Already, through our correspondence, I have made tremendous leaps in improving my well-being. For the first time in a long time, if not ever, my mind feels clear. This space, I must confess, has been a significant part of my growth. I have been caught so long in the shadow of our family's name, and it has allowed me to ignore the truth of who I really am. For my continued self-improvement, I kindly ask you to respect my wishes and grant me the space I require from you and the rest of our family. For the time being, please do not contact me. When I have completed Dr. David's program, I will return to you the very best version of your sister. Until then, know all my thoughts and love are with you, Mom, Dad, and Roy. Yours always, Laura." Contrary to what Briggs had said, Margaret thought, this explained nothing. 29. Hayden and I wander the long manicured paths of the old Bonaventure Cemetery, iced tea and coffee in hand, sun warming the tops of our heads. I've been here one other time, and it's as beautiful as I remember, a gorgeous interplay of light and shadow cast by the hundreds of old trees dripping in Spanish moss.
"I've always liked cemeteries,"
Hayden admits. "Really?" I say. "What about them?"
"I guess just the permanence," he says.
At my look, he adds,
"Not the bodies. I know those don't last. Even the headstones wear down. But the idea of there being one place where you can find the people who came before you, and where you go back to them."
He misses a step as we crest a hill and come into view of an active funeral, a group of people in black gathered around a grave with their heads bowed. Anguish splashes across his face. "You okay?" I ask. He glances down, pupils flaring at the sight of me, and takes my hand, tangling our fingers.
"Sorry. The last time I was at one of those, it was for Len."
I lean over to kiss his shoulder. There's nothing to apologize for. As we start walking, he studies me sidelong.
"Was your last one for your dad?"
I nod, keep my eyes ahead. "It was kind of weird. He'd been a journalist when he was younger, and tons of people he'd worked with or written about came."
"That's sweet,"
Hayden says. "It was," I agree. "But I would have liked something a little more private, I guess."
"That makes sense."
I think about Cosmo and Margaret running up the courthouse steps, half the world watching, and still those pictures feel intimate.
I wish for the 100th time that I could talk to Dad about it, about everything I spent the night transcribing and fact-checking. So far, I haven't stumbled on any other lies or half-truths, not since we talked about Nicolette. But I can't help feeling like Margaret's still keeping major secrets and wonder if Hayden's having the same experience. She and I have only 3 sessions left, and some of the very worst things to befall the Ives family are coming up. The situation with Dr. David, the arrests, the court case, the accident. I have no idea how Margaret has managed to move through life so isolated, carrying all of this on her shoulders, while I'm only 3 weeks into cataloging it and wishing desperately to share it with Hayden. As if reading my mind, he stops walking and pulls me into an embrace, tucking me against his sun-warmed body, his chin resting atop my head. And even though we're not talking about it, it does feel like some of the load shifts onto his shoulders.
"Did you see the picture?"
he says. I pull back to peer up into his face. It takes a beat for his meaning to set in. "I did, but I don't know what it means." He nods curtly, his eyes narrow and mouth tense. "Why?" I ask.
"Because you need to," he says. "Before you agree to take this job."
"So now I'm the one getting the job?" I say.
"You won me over,"
he murmurs.
"I have to assume you've won Margaret over too."
"Yeah, but I'm not sleeping with Margaret," I say.
"You're not sleeping with me either,"
he says. "Yet," I say. "And whose fault is that?" He laughs, kisses me once, and then starts walking again, tugging me along by our linked hands.
"A cemetery was a good idea."
"Bright and crowded," I say. Or crowded enough, anyway. Back at my house, after, we make dinner. Green tomato pie, fried okra, buttermilk biscuits, 2/3 of which he's never had and certainly never made. "Your parents didn't teach you how to cook at all?" I ask as we're slicing tomatoes side by side. He shakes his head.
"My mom did all the cooking, and she had a weird thing about other people being in the kitchen while she was working."
"And was that weird thing mom guilt?" I ask.
"Maybe a little,"
he allows.
"But also she told me the kitchen was her church, which was confusing since she and Dad also dragged us to First Presbyterian every single week."
I laugh, coat check on the biscuits. They could use a few more minutes.
"I think,"
he says,
"what she meant was the kitchen was her nighttime."
"Her nighttime?" I come back to stand beside him, his large hand still slowly, carefully slicing the plump tomatoes we grabbed from a farmer's market in Savannah.
"Like how I used to wander after everyone went to sleep,"
he says.
"Looking back, I think she liked the privacy and the control."
He pauses for a beat.
"I know my parents love each other, but I don't think she was well-suited to be a politician's wife, no matter how small time."
"What do you think she was meant for, then?" I say, curious. His shoulders lift.
"I don't know. When she was a teenager, she wanted to be a singer, but she had stage fright. Ended up on a stage anyway, though."
I think of the labyrinth on Margaret's property, the path that winds all through her workshop, unicursal, one beginning, one end, or depending on how you look at it, no beginning and no end, just a journey. "Do you think we have free will?" I ask. He lets out a verifiable bark of laughter that lights me up from the inside.
"You,"
he says,
"surprise me more than anyone I've ever met."
"So I take that as a yes," I say, "to free will?" He sets his knife aside.
"Without researching it?"
Such a journalistic response. I fight a smile. Gut instinct, yes or no?
"I think."
He raises his eyes to the ceiling, then settles them on my face.
"I think there's so much out of our control. Almost everything about how our lives go. But I think deciding that we're all just on a track, that we never really had any say over our own decisions, it feels like the kind of thing someone with a lot of regrets would need to be true. Maybe I need something different to be true."
"Like what?" I ask.
"That we don't have to end up with regrets,"
he says.
"That if we really care about something, we can decide to hold on to it."
I prefer that version of the world, I say, smiling up at him. His arms ring my waist, his nose scraping along mine.
You do?
I nod, the movement gliding our lips briefly across each other.
It's yours,
he offers. I laugh. Oh, I can have the world?
Mine,
he says.
Yeah, you can have mine.
That first year of marriage was the best and worst that I'd lived thus far,
Margaret tells me. We're side by side in her garden, the sky gray and overcast, but the heat thicker than ever. My body feels like a swamp, my bangs plastered to my forehead as I dig out yet another bundle of weeds from the flower bed in front of me, my recording devices face up on the grass between us.
At first, I tried to honor Laura's request,
she goes on, still digging, huffing from the effort.
I waited a full month to write to her, and I waited a full month after that for a reply that never came before writing again. I didn't hear anything back, of course. Sometimes I was furious, other times I was devastated. Mostly I was worried. My parents had tried contacting her, too. Mom got one reply, asking for more space. Laura said something about how every time we crossed the boundary, it set her healing journey back and made it so she'd have to be away longer.
Did you know what she meant by healing journey? I ask.
Not at all, she says. I was reading Dr. David's books, trying to make sense of things, but it honestly sounded like a whole lot of nothing. He used big words, sentences so long you'd lose track of where they'd started, and everything was so vague. The main thing was, he thought the world was dying. He thought humanity had crossed a threshold and there was no coming back without drastic measures. Even when my sister had been back in the Ives bubble, she'd wrestled with anxiety, and the apocalyptic slant of his teachings spoke to her.
Is that what you think drew her to David Ryan Atwood? Existential dread? She sits back on her heels, wiping a bead of sweat from her forehead.
That and loneliness. She'd lost our grandfather, and our parents were busy, and I wasn't as present as I could have been.
She told you to go out with Cosmo, I remind her.
I know, she says. And I could never regret that, believe me. But the thing is, some people aren't meant to be aimless. I was okay with just living, whatever that looked like, before I met Cosmo. And after that, I was mostly okay with just loving him, being loved by him. Laura was so smart. She should have been in a graduate program or doing surgery, maybe, I don't know, working for NASA. But having everything at her fingertips, every single door open to her, I think it made it hard for her to find any kind of purpose. I think she was taken in by that man because he saw her, and so few people did. I read some of his first letters to her, you know, way later. He told her she was brilliant, which was true. He told her she could help heal the world, which mattered to her. And he told her she was suffocating inside our family, inside her life. And that wasn't wrong either. The problem is, he told her all that stuff for a reason.
To manipulate her? I ask. She nods somberly, freeing another weed with long, tangly roots.
She was brilliant and compassionate and stifled, Margaret says. But she was also from one of the richest and most powerful families. We didn't know until later that she'd been sending him money for weeks before he convinced her to come out to his center. She probably funded the whole thing, honestly.
Did you keep writing to her after your mom got the letter? I say.
I was too scared to, she says. She made it sound like there was a set amount of time she'd need to be away from me, and I was only making that window grow every time I reached out, so I tried just being patient. After about 5 more months, my parents, Cosmo, and I decided to hire a private detective. He went out to New Mexico for a couple of weeks, and he came back with all these big black-and-white photographs. And there she was, my sister, with Dr. David and another woman who looked a few years older than her.
How did she look? I ask. Something flashes across her face, dark and lightning fast, akin to shame.
She'd lost more weight.
Now that I know how things ended up, I realize I should have paid more attention to that, but at the time, the thing is, she was smiling.
She looks at me dead on, her pale blue eyes filling with tears even now, 60 years after the fact. She blinks them away and goes back to digging.
Laughing, smiling, she looked happy. Sometimes she was holding his hand. I remember one where her hair was blowing out behind her as they walked down the street with all these bags of produce. In every single picture, she looked happy. It was a relief and a dagger to my heart. After that, I promised myself I wouldn't write to her anymore. Or I guess I still wrote, but I didn't mail the letters. Every time I had something I wanted to say to her, which was all the time, I'd write it down and tuck it into a drawer. Pretty soon I had dozens, hundreds maybe, stored all over my family's home and Cosmo's place in Nashville and our house in Beverly Hills. Just seeing her happy like that, it gave me a lot of mileage. Sometimes I was happy too, almost unbearably happy, for weeks at a time. And then something would happen, and I'd think of my sister, remember I no longer had her, and I'd barely be able to drag myself out of bed.
I'm sorry, I say. That's terrible.
Cosmo had to go back on tour, and I started out with him, but I hated it, really hated it. I loved traveling with my husband, but it was hard sharing him like that. It got lonely. Half the time, all I could think was, I wonder if Laura's written back yet. So finally, I went home.
Then what? I say.
The press noticed, she says with a wry smile. Every day it was something different. Articles suggesting we were splitting up, photographs of him and every beautiful woman he so much as spoke to while we were apart, along with plenty of implications that speaking was the least of what he was doing. The worst part is, I wasn't sure. I didn't ask because I didn't want to find out anything that could ruin our marriage, and I sure as hell didn't want him to lie. I knew he loved me, and I focused on that. He'd call me every single day, sometimes twice, and a couple of times I flew in to surprise him at shows. He was always thrilled. If there were other women waiting in his dressing room, they were always gone by the time he and I got back there. Sometimes we'd talk about having kids, but the first time we had a pregnancy scare, I'd never felt that kind of terror. I couldn't have even told you why. Cosmo was great about comforting me. I more or less sobbed for 6 hours until my period started, and once the relief set in, we had a fight. We almost never fought. It just wasn't a part of our relationship, for good or bad. I never felt like we needed to agree on things, and he never pushed me to do anything I didn't want to. But he was upset by my reaction, that I wasn't sure if I wanted children.
She shoots me a meaningful glance.
Probably it would have been a more important question to ask before we got married than what's your middle name.
What would you have said, I say, if he'd asked that? She blew out a breath.
I would have said I don't know, because I didn't. And after that fight, I felt even less sure. In a moment of weakness, I wrote another letter to my sister, and this time I sent it. I told her everything she'd missed. I told her about the baby that didn't exist and how conflicted I felt about bringing anyone new into this world. I even tried to butter her up by asking if Dr. David had any wisdom on the matter. She didn't reply, of course. But after that letter, I felt like I found some peace with the situation. It never got easier being without her, but I got used to how it felt to carry that pain with me. I learned to put it on a shelf and live my life. We threw parties and hosted lavish dinners. We went to galas and award ceremonies and charity fundraisers. We fought and made up, fucked and made love, and he wrote me ballads so sweet that the first note could make your heart break.
A bittersweet smile sweeps across her face, even as her eyes stay trained on the garden bed.
On Sundays, when we were in Los Angeles, we had family dinners with my parents and Roy at the house, and whenever my dad was in one of his divorced phases, Cosmo and I would stay there for weeks at a time. My grandmother had passed away, and my great-aunt Gigi had moved to Paris, so he needed the company. We packed a whole life into those short years together. Cosmo's schedule had slowed down since the Beatles set foot in America in February of 1964, but the paparazzi seemed keener than ever to catch him doing something scandalous or me doing something horrible. We did our best to shut it out, but I could see how it grated on him, the way his world had shrunk so hard and fast. Writers who'd fawned over him 5 years earlier were mocking him now. The boy wonder of rock and roll was looking older by the minute. The more time went on, the less we talked about Laura. It was too painful, and Dad, as he got older, leaned more into his anger. Probably easier that way, to rage against how she'd turned her back on us instead of mourning that she was out of reach. "And your mother?" I asked. Eventually, she admitted to me that she'd kept that private investigator, she says. Dad wouldn't fund it anymore. He was too hurt and angry, so she couldn't get as many check-ins as she would have liked, but every 6 months or so, she'd get a new envelope of pictures delivered to her. And then one Sunday night, after dinner, my father set his silverware down and stood up and said, "Bernie, Margaret, I need to speak with you in the drawing room, a family meeting."
Roy and Cosmo weren't included, I note.
Dad had always welcomed Cosmo into the family, and to a lesser extent, Roy, she says, so I knew this had to be something delicate. We went into the library while Roy and Cosmo had dessert. I remember there was a fire roaring in there, even though it was the dead of summer in California, but that was Dad. He had his routines. He had us sit down then and blurted it out without any kind of preamble. He just said it. "We're being extorted." Mom nearly fell out of her chair. "By whom?" I remember her asking. "For what?" But something about the look on my father's face broadcast the answer loud and clear to me. I just knew. Then he pulled the letter out of his dinner jacket and handed it to us. The funny thing is, well, not funny, but, you know, peculiar, is that I didn't even care about what Dad had said once I saw that handwriting. All that mattered to me was that Laura was okay, that she was finally writing to us.
The story. Their version. Laura Ives was the right hand of the high control group, the People's Moment for Metaphysical Healing. Laura Ives was just another victim of David Ryan Atwood. Laura Ives was a sucker. Laura Ives was a mastermind. She was a villain. She was a fool. Her version. When she was small, Laura loved zebras. The family had had some for a time. They'd gotten them because her grandfather's mistress made a crack about wanting one. They'd gotten rid of them when Laura was 11, and her heart couldn't take seeing them in captivity anymore. Freddie had granted his younger daughter's wish immediately. He wasn't attached to the zebras. He wasn't attached to much in his father's mansion on the coast. For some reason, he just continued doing things the way Gerald always had. Freddie's anger was like his father's, too, flaring up whenever control over his life slipped out of his grasp. Freddie may have never stormed out on his family the way his father had, but he'd let his jealousy and shame destroy his marriage all the same. He didn't understand how it worked, why he couldn't stop himself from driving off the people he loved most in the world, how he always ended up right back here in this big, empty castle. He never said any of this aloud, not to anyone. He wouldn't have known how to begin or when to say it. But Margaret wasn't the only person writing letters that were never sent. Years later, after he died, she'd read them. Most, heartbreakingly, were to her mother. But many were for Laura, and for her. The night he told Bernie and Margaret about the extortion, about the $4 million Laura was demanding in order to keep her grandfather's secrets, he was strangely calm, as if all that anger, covering up the pain and regret, had calcified into something stable rather than explosive. Steel, a blade. They argued for a while about what to do. Bernie cried, a startling rarity, and just as startling was the way Margaret's father wrapped her mother in his arms, soothing her. It had been so long since she'd seen them touch each other like that. They were a true family in that moment, which only made Laura's absence more pronounced. The problem with determining what to do was none of them knew Gerald Ives's secrets or how much they were worth. Only Laura did. Bernie was inclined to give her the money on the chance Laura might actually need it, that it might soften her stance concerning the family. Freddie was inclined to refuse.
She won't be able to prove anything she says, he reasoned, and if we pay them once, they'll keep asking for more.
Then we give them more, Margaret said. Who cares? If it brings Laura back...
How would it bring her back? Freddie said.
Rhetorically, Margaret figured, but she had an answer ready.
We'll give it to her, she said, but only to her, in person.
Bernie straightened up at that.
There's no reason to think she'll agree to that, Freddie reasoned. Those weren't her terms.
Then we negotiate new ones, Margaret insisted. We have to try. It took 5 days to set the plans, all orchestrated over quick phone calls made from public telephones by a woman who wasn't Laura and gave them no name. All the usual stipulations you saw in the movies were made. No police, come alone, tell no one, no funny business. The calls came straight to the Ives family home, fielded by Freddie at all hours of the day and night. But after the meeting was set, the three of them agreed it should be Margaret who went. She told Cosmo she was going to see her sister, but didn't dare give him the details, beyond that Laura had agreed to meet. Any more information than that, and they would have found themselves in their second real fight. A fight without any purpose, since nothing Cosmo could possibly say would change Margaret's mind about this. Darren drove her to the diner, out in Palm Springs, with strict instructions to leave her there for exactly 2 hours. Whomever Freddie had spoken to on the phone was adamant that no one else from the Ives family or representing it could be present, or the deal was off, and whatever information Laura had would be released. Not that that mattered to Margaret, but it was important that Dr. David and whoever else believe it did, or she doubted she'd ever see her sister again. The diner was grubby and mostly empty. The air inside was stiff and thick with cigarette smoke. Margaret took a seat with her back to the corner, where she'd have a clear view of the front door. A man in drab gray clothes sat in the corner exactly opposite her, and she couldn't tell whether he was watching her or not, but she decided it was wise to treat him as if he were, just in case. The bells over the door rang 3 times, 2 customers coming and 1 going, before Laura finally walked in, and at first, Margaret's eyes grazed right over her the same way they had the stranger's. It took her several seconds after Laura made eye contact to recognize the emaciated woman in the sagging brown dress as her sister. Her hair looked lank, her face pale and sickly. Worst of all, when she saw Margaret, something like fear flared through her eyes. Fear. She was afraid of her sister. Margaret thought she might throw up. She willed herself to smile. Laura began walking toward her. She seemed to float almost. She lowered herself into the booth and with a frail, rattling voice said, "Dad was supposed to come." Margaret's heart split open. She'd had a plan. She'd meant to get answers, to talk sense into her sister, but all of that went out the window when she saw her. She noticed the man in the corner again, definitely watching them. They wouldn't have much time. She dropped her own gaze to the tar-thick coffee she'd been nursing since she got there. Her voice broke as she murmured, "Tell me what you need to get out." When she chanced to glance up, that same fear had coalesced in her sister's peaked face. "I'm not leaving," she whispered. "Do you want to?" Margaret asked, to no response. Laura's eyes were downcast, her hands trembling against the edge of the table. "Tell me what you need," Margaret said again, more slowly. Her eyes darted sideways, paranoia wafting off her. But was it really paranoia if there was something to be afraid of? She whispered, "He'll never let me go." "Tell me," Margaret said once more, low, quiet. "He won't let me," Laura replied. "He says I belong to him." An unprecedented rage knifed through Margaret. "And you think he loves you more than I do?" she hissed. "You think he'd do more to hurt you than I'd do to protect you?" She leaned forward, eager, trying to school her face into something like calm, willing the man in the corner to give them just another minute.
"You can't think that," she whispered fiercely. "I know you, and you know me. I'll win. If it's him versus me, I'll win. I won't let him take you. I'm yours, and you're mine, and he can't have you."
Laura stared back at her, tears glossing over her eyes. Back in the corner, the man in gray coughed, and Laura blinked the emotion away, her face going blank. So blank that the moment would haunt Margaret's dreams for the rest of her life, the moment she truly believed her sister had slipped away from her. Then, coolly, dispassionately, Laura said,
3488 Gates Road, September 1st, 11 a.m.
That was all. The man in the corner had risen and tossed some bills on the table. At the sound of his boots approaching, Laura went rigid. Margaret pulled the suitcase out from under the table and set it between them. The man appeared right at Laura's shoulder and reached for the suitcase before she could. Margaret didn't recognize him. He was younger than Dr. David, with a buzzed head. She thought she spotted a gun under his jacket, but it might have been her imagination. He slid the suitcase off the table and said calmly, "Go wait in the bathroom for 10 minutes. If you come out before then, we'll know." "And then what?" Margaret asked. He looked from her to Laura with a smile that chilled Margaret's core. She nodded and stood, excusing herself to the tiny, dumpy bathroom in the back of the Too Hot diner. She hadn't worn a watch and there was no clock in the restroom, so she counted 60 seconds for a minute 10 times. And then, because she wasn't sure she'd counted correctly, she did it all again. She went back to her table, finished her coffee, and waited for Darren to loop back for her. With the information Laura had given them, Freddie went to the police. The police took them to the FBI. The address was an old warehouse. They had no idea what they'd find there, or if Laura would have led them on a wild goose chase, but the Ives family had enough power and money to be taken seriously. There were so many ways it could go wrong. Laura could have lied. Laura could have told the truth, then admitted as much to whoever was controlling her. Laura could have gotten it wrong. She could have gotten it right, and whatever was meant to happen at 3488 Gates Road had been postponed, or moved up, or canceled entirely. Even if they found evidence of criminal activity, there was no guarantee they'd have enough to prosecute David. But none of that mattered as much as getting Laura away from him. This was a means to do that. At 11 a.m. on September 1st, the FBI raided a warehouse registered to a man named Bill Jones. They arrived several minutes after a large shipment of illegally obtained guns. 3 members of the People's Moment were killed, along with 1 agent, in the crossfire that followed. Each of those people had a name. Each of them had loved ones they'd cut themselves off from, fear and anger and pain that the world would never know about. They'd be mentioned in articles for months afterward, written about in books for years longer. But Laura would be at the center of everything. She wasn't there to receive the shipment. She was back at the center on the other side of town with David and 3 other women he considered his wives. Federal agents swarmed them, too. But David and the women barricaded themselves in a bathroom. It took 7 hours to get them out. There was nothing illicit in that room or on the center's grounds. Dr. David's name wasn't associated with the warehouse full of weapons and schematics and in-depth plans for the assassination of several high-ranking government officials. With Laura's testimony, it wouldn't matter. She could connect all the dots. The problem was, she was a wreck when they found her. Underweight, sleep-deprived, strung out on a mix of stimulants and depressants. He kept Laura Ives and several other women in a highly suggestible state, a doctor would testify after David's lawyers tried to pin everything on Laura. If Margaret thought Laura's state at the diner was bad, it was nothing compared to Laura in the aftermath of the raid. She jumped easily, barely slept, got sick when she tried to eat. David had had her on a diet of mostly liquids and fruit, juices and sugary sodas he called her medicine. They were supposed to cleanse her of something or another. She suffered from terrible nightmares and she didn't trust doctors, though logically she now knew David Ryan Atwood wasn't a real doctor. Her mind was at war with itself. She didn't know what was real and what wasn't. He'd distorted her view of reality so thoroughly that she didn't trust her instincts. For the first few weeks, she'd stayed back at the family home, rereading Lawrence's old journals again, their familiarity a balm to her. Most nights, Margaret and Cosmo stayed in the next room over, but when they couldn't, Bernie and Roy took their place. Margaret wanted nothing but to hold her sister close and promise everything would be all right, but Laura had spent the last several years being told that her family was watching her, controlling her, and she still flinched when Margaret reached for